I have been doing a little hacking here, as a matter of fact.
Computers and the programs will start thinking, and the people will stop.
They can't afford to have an independent programmer monitoring me. Do you realize how many outside systems I've gone into? How many programs I've appropriated?
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
God, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in far enough, I could reconstruct it.
Everyone, welcome to the February 20th edition of the In the Now Show. Your host, Slip Mode, along with
Bob.
Bob in the house. We're using Bob this time?
Yeah.
Bob, okay. Going for Bob.
I always go with a different name.
All right.
Bob with an extra B, by the way. There's two B's at the end.
All right. Is there a zero for the O or what?
No.
No?
No, that's lame.
Okay. All right, that's good. All right, well, we're back with another show. And as promised in this show, we do have an interview with Rocket from InnerZone. So towards the end of the show, we'll be playing that interview for all the listeners out there. We'll be talking about InnerZone that comes out here March 11th through the 13th down in Atlanta. And you can check that out at innerzone.com. Zone with a zero instead of a O, because it's cool.
Yeah.
Just like Slip Mode with zeros and ones. Yeah, nobody gets that email address right, by the way. They just mess it up with the L and the 1, and it's terrible. I need to fix it. All right, well, we got a lot of information for you on this show, as usual. And here goes. All right, well, somebody out there actually released 240,000 names on the Internet that comprised of names of former agents of the Secret Service Police for Poland, covert informers, and proven victims of former communist regimes' elaborate espionage network.
Wow.
Yeah, let's see here. Unlike Germany, Poland has opened up its communist era secret hasn't opened up its communist era secret file archives to the public. Now, an internet publication by Polish journalist of a list containing names of informers and victims has sparked an uproar. So, I don't know. It's kind of interesting. You don't really know who's who because it says, there are people in there that have been affected from, the communist regime's elaborate espionage network. So, how do you parse out the victims and whatnot? But I was actually doing a little talk with VR, and we did a little calculation where we took the population of Poland, which is around like 38.5 million people, that we looked that up on the CIA fact book, and divided by 240,000. Well, that'd be great if I was using the calculator and not the browser. For every one citizen, there's 158. For every 158 citizens, sorry, totally backwards, long day. There's one person in this list. Now, obviously, all those people aren't spies, but that's, for the amount of people that's in this list, I don't know who are the spies and who aren't, but that's a significant amount of intelligence gathering people involved.
Just kill them all.
Yeah. that was published, and a lot of people are looking at it over there. And actually, one website that had it had up to 100,000 clicks daily. So that's quite a bit of traffic. Polish's secret police, known as the SB, has much in common with the other secret police agencies in former communist countries, in that it was known for its brutality and kept tabs on much of the population. The SB has records of some 98,000 secret spies in 1988. So actually, if we move that to the number that they had in 1988, for every one person, sorry, every 357 people in Poland, there was one person to keep tabs on them. That's a pretty significant number of intelligent power in one area. So they could be informers all over the place. That's why I read Bob's email.
You wish.
You wish.
The emails you know about.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, it's not too hard since I run the router. That's all right. The list posting on the internet has also sent alarm bells ringing through Poland's existing secret police because it contains the names of agents who are still active. Polish Prime Minister Marek Belka has already demanded the Polish police secret service. I'm all over the place. Ensure that agencies on active duty aren't affected by the Wadstein revelations.
You were just all over that news, dude. Like,
all right, and this is something that brought a lot to my attention, and I want to discuss quite a bit about. This is a school that's in Sutter Rice County, and basically they're using RFID to track the kids at the school. It's kindergarten through eighth grade, as when they get to class, when they get off and on buses and stuff like that. And to me, I don't know, that just raises quite a few issues, and there's a lot of pros and cons that come with that, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. Angry parents saying that their children's privacy rights are being violated have asked the board of the Tiny Britain School District to rescind a requirement that all students wear badges that monitor their whereabouts on campus using radio signals. Located between the massive silos of Sutter Rice Company County and the Sutter Buttes, this small town has 587 kindergarten through 8th graders who are the first public schools in the country to be tracked on campus by such a system, which is designed to ease attendance taking and increase campus security. This is the only public monitoring, public school monitoring where children go, with kids walking around with little homing beacons, said Nicole Ozer. Basically, it just goes into a lot of the parents were very upset about the mandatory need to have these RFID tags. And one of the school's responses was that, you know, they cannot be tracked up to, you know, long distances. These are things that only pick up the signal from up to about 15 feet away.
Yeah, because pedophiles don't hang out around the school.
Yeah, so the tag too. They also put readers. So how it works is they put readers at the classroom doors. They also put readers in the bathrooms, but they ended up not doing that, not turning those on because that kind of, I don't know why they needed information, and I think that was kind of a little etchy. So they decided not to do that. But the pros and cons. You know, I was talking with VR about this. Unfortunately, didn't be able to make it to the show. But the pros to this. Is it just allows the staff to be a little bit lazier. And then, you know, because in all honesty, attendance record taking isn't that tough, and a lot of times they have, each classroom has its own computer, and they just kind of do the attendance in there. And then they get sent back to a main database anyways. So, I mean, really, what's the difference? And also, one of the cons, basically, is that you're kind of eliminating that teacher-student relationship to some degree to where, you know, they're checking in and talking to each student and making sure that they're there. And it's just kind of like, okay, all the blips say they're here, okay, good, fine, move along, you know? And it's just like, it's just more alienation. But the biggest thing that I really feel with this whole system is that it doesn't provide any benefit to the school whatsoever. The cost of the system to implement is not mentioned in the article, but it is a cost above and beyond the few seconds it takes for the teachers to do attendance themselves. And also, the system of tracking, I mean, the way that I think about getting around it is it's described as roughly the size of a roll of dimes is this little tag. And I don't think it's very hard to actually just take that tag and give it to your buddy and say, hey, can you go to, because you go to all my classes, why don't you just take this tag and then I'll walk around with a fake tag around school because I'm sure you have to prominently show it. And I'll just be able to go where I want and they think I'm okay because you know, I'm participating in the system and I must be trusted because I'm walking around with a tag and there's no alarms going off. So, to me, I really don't see there's much of a benefit, and it seems like it's really easy to get around what that tag does. And, I don't know, it just allows people to be a little bit more lazier and rely on technology. So, when a problem comes about, all they really have to do is just blame the fact that, you know, well, the tag, you know, the student is supposed to have it and it showed up in my class that student was here, you know. So then you got to say you have to get back to the humans policing anyways in the first place. So I think it's a big waste, and I don't really see much of a reason to go beyond that. And it seems like the fact that they implemented it in the first place, that's great. You're just breathing in that mic. That's great, Bob. That's awesome. I don't really see that it's really beneficial whatsoever. And if anybody has some pros that I'm not thinking of, feel free to post on the forums. but
I really see no positive side to doing something like that.
No, but it's really it's really a direction that I don't see as being advantageous to anybody. Also, we're going to be talking about in the show this online game that I actually showed Bob and been playing it myself. So we're going to mention that as well a little bit later. Okay, well, this is it's kind of some talk about Microsoft and opening up some more of their source code that they've opened up, like, I don't know, like 0.1% of it. And, you know, and it's talking about, like, really, it's one of those articles that kind of broads a few things together and starting to talk about, well, you know, what are they going to open up next? And it talks a little bit about, like, .NET and opening that might be a better thing for them. But one of the things that it said, and this is why I want to bring it up, and it's kind of funny, is that they have a hesitancy to opening up some of their source code because it includes the intellectual property rights and the scrubbing of the scrubbing the code of inappropriate comps. Usually when you write a piece of code, it's good to comment each function and what that function does in order for a developer to catch on and figure out what the program's doing so he's able or she is able to develop for that program more easily. And it's just, you know, it's just better understood and laid out in a better process. So open source people do that quite a bit because there's a lot of outside eyes that are going to be getting onto that code and they need to understand what's going on. So they do it not only for themselves, you know, to help the other people out, but they're actually doing it for themselves because if everybody follows that policy, it helps things out for when they start jumping on those projects. But when you're in the Microsoft world and it's closed source, you can pretty much say a few things if you want because you're maybe maintaining the project or you're the group that's going to be working on it. And also it's closed source. So I remember taking a look at that Windows 2000 source code that got leaked on the internet, and there was quite a few comments out there. Like, I should have gotten it ready ahead of time and actually grep some of those things out to look at to bring out specific examples. But it's pretty funny because it has, you know, references to like, okay, this code is crap, but it works for right now. We'll think about like upgrading it in the future. I remember something like that was being said. And then also, there was just miscellaneous comments in there that were kind of funny and wouldn't give much luster to Microsoft to those kinds of things for more public. And also, I'm sure there's probably a comment in there like, you know, took this code from open source project, you know, need to develop our own code at some point, you know, works for now, or something like that, so...
If they did that too much, their software would probably work.
Yeah, their software probably... No, I don't think so, because their whole thinking of the way they develop software is completely in the face of... I'm not talking about the closed and open source, but I just a lot of their theories about how to do programming the way it should be done is quite different from the open source way. But obviously, substructures of routines that constantly happen, like a TCP/IP stack or a function that is just going to be what it is, and it's not going to be something that's compounded upon with features and options and crap and stuff like that, is obviously pretty easy to, in, you know, enter that into a system like that. All right. Well, we talked a bit about the PlayStation 3 and oncoming video game systems that are going to be coming out here in the near future. I think at the next Consumer Electronics Show, they will be showcasing the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox 2. And I'm not sure if Nintendo is going to be doing theirs, but because I believe that they're going to be coming out with theirs a little bit later than everybody else's. But I finally got it, because I've been following this, and it's been very interesting to me, because I'm a big video game guy, but I also am excited about, you know, some of the technology that's going to be under the hood of the new consoles that can come out there, because I think the graphics right now are really good and amazing, and I think it's just going to be just insane. And also, I've been very interested in the cell processor, and I dug up some information on some of the details about the cell processor, and here it goes. Basically, engineers from Sony, IBM, Toshiba have revealed some of the specifications for the cell processor during a press conference at the International Solid State Circuits Conference, where technical papers on cell design were presented. The three companies have been working on cell for several years, promising to deliver high performance on chip optimized for multimedia applications. Test production of cell chips is set to begin later this year, and the processors will appear later in workstation PCs optimized for animation and other graphics chores. The chip will also power the next version of Sony's PlayStation game console, which is widely expected to be released late this year or early next year. Cell will have a 64-bit IBM power processor and 8 synergistic processing units capable of handling separate computing tasks. The power processor will act as the brain of the chip, running the main operating system for an application and divvying up chores for the other processors. The 8 synergistic processors are a step forward from current computing designs in which the graphic chips draw pixels and the central processor does everything else. The cell cores have media-specific instructions baked in, but they are flexible and smart enough to handle non-media tasks. It represents an important middle ground between graphics processors and central processors. The multi-core design will give software developers tremendous flexibility, allowing them to run multiple operating systems on the same chip and experiment with variations on grid computing. So, I mean, it's basically a multi-processor system together, and it's all put on one die. And I know that Intel is coming out with, and AMD is coming out with, their dual-core processors, which is basically two processors on one chip. And the way that you can code for this type of the cell processor allows you to open up your options as to computing and balancing and stuff like that. So it's basically a little cluster on one chip. The version of the chip will run at speeds faster than 4 gigahertz. Engineers were vague about how much faster, but reports from design partners say 4.6 gigahertz is likely by comparison. The current Pentium processor tops out at 3.8 gigahertz. Cell can process 256 billion calculations per second. Falling a wee short bit of the marketing hyperbole calling a supercomputer on a chip, the slowest machine on the current list of top 500 supercomputers can do 851 gigaflops. Well, this one processor does 256 gigaflops, so throw four of those together and you're number 499 on the supercomputer list. The chip will have 2.5 megs of on-chip memory and have the ability to shuttle data on and off the chip memory at speeds of up to 100 gigabytes per second using XDR and FlexIO interface technology licensed from Rambus. One of the key messages you hear from the architects of the next generation chips is that their performance will be limited by off-chip bandwidth. We've really licked that with Cell. 100 gigabytes per second is really unprecedented in the industry. The chip will have 234 million transistors measuring 221 millimeters square and be produced using advanced 90 nanometer chip making processes. They expect the production to shift to 65 nanometer processes soon as the IBM introduces the chip making technology later this year. And then some other details too is that the processes on there are called SPEs, which are, okay, where is it at here? Synergistic processing elements. They take 128-bit operands, split them into four 32-bit words. Up to 128 operands can be stored in a register file. Each 2.5 times 5.81 millimeter SPE can issue two instructions per cycle to seven execution units using two pipelines. So it's shooting two commands out at one time, much like the AMD 64-bit processors do when they split out two 32-bit processes. There is no out-of-order execution. Connecting up the processing units is the element interconnected bus, EIB, comprising 428-bit rings and a 64-bit tag running on at half the processor clock. The buses connect to the SPEs through the local memory, 256 kilobytes for each SPE, so that's their onboard cache. Developers have tested the memories to 5.4 gigahertz at 1.3 volts and 52 degrees Celsius. There are 15 separate power domains on the chip, 10 digital thermometers monitoring the chip at various points to alert the system of thermal problems. So that's one badass chip. And, you are able they're talking about, too, for the PlayStation 3. They said that, developers, it really is up to them as to how they want to utilize those processing cores and see how they want to pulled it all together. But that's pretty amazing that someone like IBM has come out of the box with a chip that tops whatever's out there in the market now. And AMD and Intel are always at it trying to get faster speeds. But obviously this is a much different design than what current computing designs are. And it's basically taking kind of like a clustering load balancing system all together, intertwined on one die, and uses the XDR RAM, which is what we talked about in the last show, which is 10 times faster than the PC 400 RAM that they have nowadays. which is built off the Rambus RAM technology, which is twice as fast as the current RAM technology today. And the XDR will be five times faster than that. So that RAM is insanely quick, and it's going to be used in the PlayStation 3. What I did read, too, is I found out that the ATI will be developing for the Xbox, and actually NVIDIA will be developing for Nintendo's new console, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Bob, you hanging in there? You're alive?
Yeah.
Alright.
I'm hearing weird sounds in the headphones.
Alright.
Yeah.
Take the headphones off. Let me know if you still hear those sounds. okay. And this, there's a lot of things going on in the world of what is real and what isn't, as far as, you know, we've talked a lot about, like, intellectual property. We've talked about, you know, lawsuits over that, movies, MP3s, stuff like that. What about a virtual world? What about your role-playing games or you're playing online? What about those properties or your character? You know, does that hold any value? Can you bring that to court? Can you sue over that? And here's some questions to think about. Take virtual property. One of the questions is, how do we treat property in virtual worlds? Second, we accord them the same protection as, or should we record them the same protection as property in the real world? Imagine your virtual world avatar, basically your character, wore a little amulet and it was stolen by another avatar. Would you classify that as theft? Probably not. Many virtual worlds, particularly massive multiplayer online role-playing games, theft is allowed. It's considered part of the role-playing experience. But money has a way of changing everything. If virtual world goods and money hold a value in a real-world economy, why can't they hold value in the courts? As we've seen with EverQuest and stuff like that, where people have sold things. We actually talked about a virtual island that was sold on eBay for, I believe, like $30,000. Actually, it's already happened. The court, although the court ruling was in China, in 2003, a virtual world developer had to compensate a player in cash after a hacker stole his virtual goods. Now, take the idea of digital property one step further. Imagine someone investing time and money via, like, a monthly subscription to an online game into a virtual world. She's made friends, built a reputation, and spent a fair amount of time collecting and creating virtual goods. All of a sudden, poof, her work disappears when the game creator, faced with a losing business, pulls the plug. Time to get a life may be their easy response, but for many, the virtual world is their life. On average, the player spent 22 hours a week online. According to Nikki, a virtual world anthropologist who has been documenting MMORPG since 1999, massive
multiplayer online role-playing games.
As we spent much more time in these worlds, it's not enough for companies to say that we own everything and we can turn it off at any time. The question may soon should be asked, should we have recourse against a game for obliterating assets? And we've also talked about, well, we haven't talked about, but people like, you know, the X-Men and Spider-Man franchises and stuff like that, and lawsuits with that, and obviously things with the MP3s and movies and all that. So it's there's a thinning line with reality and fantasy. Obviously, no, it's fantasy, but, I mean, a lot of people are really contributing and doing things online and making things happen and meeting people and impacting one another's lives, and obviously the game is just a medium to do that, but so is going out and having fun, and I have a certain place you hang out, and things happen there, discussions and ideas and things like that. Now, I honestly believe that if that thing gets into courts or you're really able to sue over that stuff, then there's a big problem, because I really think that people need to spend most of their time in the real world. Because usually when you're trying to get out of the real world, it's because you're having a problem and you're trying to escape it. You know, obviously there's a healthy escape and an unhealthy escape, but I think if it gets too far, that's going to be a little crazy. I think that things should definitely stay in the reality of where things are, and if you lose your save game, then, I don't know, things happen.
I don't think that will ever make it into the courts. I mean, if you think about it, these people put out the game, they put out the world, the company owns it, they own the intellectual property to the amulet that you think you own, but you really don't actually own it. It's not your property. it's ones and zeros that were generated by a company, and they hold intellectual property to what those ones and zeros represent.
Yeah, that's right.
You can't really own something on a virtual game. At least that's my opinion.
Well, yeah, because, you know, that's the one thing that you need to look at is if you're actually just renting that experience. Or if it's just giving out freely, then you're just, you know, freely available to you. But I don't know. There's companies out there with games that have impacted people by violence or whatnot that, you know, they've had lawsuits against them. And I don't actually know if anybody ever won. But I know that some game makers have cut back on violence or things like that just to appease others. So I'm not sure, but it's something to look at and watch. I mean, seriously, people are getting more and more in-depth in the way that these worlds are, and they're getting more realistic all the time, especially with the advancement of technology and, you know, just the evolution of virtual experiences evolving all the time. So, okay, this is something interesting. If you know the DDoS Mafia, you might not want to talk to them anymore because they were let up on a criminal complaint filed against them in August, back in 2003, I believe it was. No, 2004, which they were involved in doing denial services against companies and also extorting them for money to stop doing denial services. The charges were dropped because they're going to rat out a few people.
Oh, man.
So, you know, you might want to be careful if you know those guys.
I got to go shred some papers. I'll be right back.
Yeah. On January 18th, a magistrate judge from the Central District of California granted prosecution motion to dismiss without prejudice the complaint against Paul Garrett Ashley, the operator of Creative Internet Techniques, also known as Funet, and three alleged accomplices, Jonathan David Hall, Joshua James Schitzel, and Richard Robbie. The complaint against a fourth man, Lee Graham Walker of the United States, was not dismissed and still pending according to authorities. He must not know very many people. So, yeah, the defendants were originally accused of carrying out attacks on behalf of Jay Uchifani, a Massachusetts businessman who sold satellite TV gear via his website. At an August 26, 2004 press conference, Attorney General Ashcroft said the attacks cost the victims, who were competitors of Fuchani, over $2 million in lost revenue and mitigation efforts. So, yes. It's very interested that that's going to be let go in order to
catch some big fish.
Yeah. I don't know, if you're doing stuff like that, that's a pretty decent sized fish. I think they got
always
really
a bigger fish.
I think they really got lucky on that deal.
Oh, definitely.
They really got lucky. All right. Funet. Also, Sun is floating around the idea about putting out an open source database out there. One of the things is that unlike rivals IBM and Microsoft, Sun has no database software to sell in its $13.5 billion market that Oracle leads. Lacking a database is significant, giving Sun's argument that customers want to buy a package of integrated technology rather than parts that must be assembled. Instead, Sun relies on a tight partnership with database giant Oracle. And most people that run Sun, and they usually run them for databases, typically have Oracle installed. Offering an open source database that competes directly with Oracle's cash cow might not sit well with a business, a major business partner that also has strong partnerships with Dell and Hewlett Packard, but Sun has shown a willingness recently to tussle with Oracle. Basically, it's called SunDB, and I honestly don't know if it's already out there, and they just want to open it because I've never used it. I don't think it's out there, but it's, you know, it's interesting that they're thinking about doing that, as well as, and I don't know if they're going to release it under their license that they have now, which I forget what it is, common something something. But or if they're actually going to do it like under a GNU type license, probably not a GNU type.
The Creative Commons license.
The Creative Commons license. It's not the Creative Commons license, is that it?
I don't know.
I forget. You know what? Honestly, I forget. I'd have to pull it up. But yeah. So they're probably going to release under the license that they have been using. But and I'm going to try to pull it up here so I can get this right. But also, you know, you can still run, you know, MySQL and stuff like that on the Solaris box. So, and, you know, a lot of people have been using it, and it's been pretty effective. So let's see if we can get that going. It is the CDDL, which, I cannot believe I'm forgetting this, is the Common Development and Distribution License. Okay, yeah, and that we've talked about that a little bit before. I've read that license, and it's still quite confusing because there are a few ways that you can go with that license that can be bad and good. But anyways, getting back to the story, yeah, they're thinking about doing that. So it's just interesting to watch Sun with what they're doing. I've downloaded Solaris 10. I haven't had a chance to put it on yet, but I am very interested in trying it out. They are trying to do the dual role as best they can because they knew that the whole idea of Linux is working very well, and they wanted to tackle that as well as being one of the best-known Unix platforms out there. So BSD people might disagree, but it's one of the, you know, it's a well-known Unix platform, and it's been around for quite a long time. So we'll just see how things keep going and how this dual role of proprietary and not-so-proprietary code works out there in the big world of software. Okay, and also, if you didn't know that you can get a license out there to clone humans, well, now you know. You got to get your permit first, and then after that you can get it. The scientist who cloned Dolly the sheep was given the go-ahead to experiment on human embryos by the government's fertility authority, Professor Ian Woolman of the Roslin Institute near Edinburgh, received a license to carry out the controversial research in a bid to find a cure for motor neuron disease. Professor Stephen Hawking and former Celtic star Jimmy Johnstone are among the sufferers of the wasting illness, which affects about 5,000 people in Britain. Actor David Niven also died from this disease. Experts believe that the research could begin to benefit patients within a decade. The human fertilization of embryology authority today approved. You know, I've been saying that word all day yesterday. Today, I just couldn't figure it out.
Sound it out, slip. Sound it out.
Yeah,
you can do it.
approved the application, marking the only the second time the HC has given the consent to clone human embryos. But campaigners today, this is back in February, today branded the research profoundly unethical and raised concerns about why the new license had been awarded with a legal challenge into the first case continues. They also claim that cloning humans beings now appeared inevitable. So, yeah, the first one's caught up in a legal battle saying, okay, it's not even legit. You can't even do that. But they're handing out a second one. And, you know, they just want to make, they just want to do what they want to do. I'm not really excited about it, but, I don't know.
When can I get my clone? I want someone to go to work for me.
Yeah, have you seen that commercial with that guy Ping?
No, what commercial?
I forget who the avatar was, but it's this Asian guy named Ping. And he says, I wanted to you know, be more efficient in my life. So that's why I cloned myself. And he's like, no, I have many pings. There's all these little pings walking around doing all these things and helping out in the community and things like that. And it's funny. And then his wife wakes up and Ping's like giving her tea, but there's another ping laying right next to her and she freaks out. But anyway, so we could all use more pings.
I don't want any pings. I want some bobs.
Bobs. All right. And also, we've talked about the Microsoft anti-spyware program that has come out. I haven't personally checked it out because I don't know. I don't really care about it so much. But Infonomicon.com, if you go over there and check out their show, their last show, they actually talk about their review of it. And I believe that Snake did a review on DinnerRev.com too. So you can check that out. But also, there is a new Trojan that comes out that, well, what do you know? Disables the anti-spyware.
Yeah. I didn't see that one coming a mile away.
No, not at all. It deletes all files within the folder named C Program Files Microsoft Anti-Spyware. The Trojan also removes important entries of the anti-spyware in the registry, and thus literally kills the anti-spyware. So, that's exciting. That's maybe why they're quickly following up to probably get into the antivirus market, where Microsoft is, to hopefully keep their spyware market. I don't know.
Yeah, until they come up with a Trojan that attacks their antivirus program. And
then they're like, you really need to buy this, because this is the only antivirus software that really works, because we made all the other ones break. So, okay.
What they need to do is contract out their software development to someone else. That way, people won't be able to attack it.
Yeah.
This makes sense.
Okay, this is an interview with Spiegel Spiegel and Bill Gates. That's Spiegel to Bill Gates. Spiegel is a guy in Germany, and he has his own publication. And there's just a few things in this interview that I was reading that I wanted to bring to the listener's attention. Here's the opening. Spiegel says, Mr. Gates, you came to Munich this week specifically to initiate a project for more internet security in Germany. The government sponsor is Labor and Economics Minister Wolfgang Clement. Why are you taking this initiative now? Gates says, The enthusiasm about how computers, the internet, and good software can help people is probably as large as it is it ever was. A lot of fantastic things have happened in the past few years. Just think about how email contact or digital business with photos or music have developed worldwide. But while we still work on the wonderful further developments, some really serious issues are being forced into the agenda, and we now have to ensure that they do not ever become a problem. Well, they've already become a problem, but they don't continue to be a problem. This stretches from annoyance from a mailbox full of junk advertisement to the risk that your computer has been taken over by hackers to spy on your data. There is a lot to do, especially for Microsoft. And skipping right along, Spiegel says, Did you underestimate the security problems a few years ago? The chief concerns of your industry were making computers more efficient and hooking up as many houses as possible. Now security is of a chief concern. Even Microsoft seems to have first become aware of the danger after September 11th. I don't know why they have to bring that up, but Gates says, the terrorist attacks of 2001 has showed people up close that where the lack of security can lead, problems with computer security have more to do with unbelievable success of the computer itself. And the more success the PC became, the more the downsides also became clear, such as, how can I prevent someone from stealing my credit cards off the internet? In some areas, the bad boys are also terribly clever and occasionally more craftier than we expected. So I didn't like the whole September 11th thing. You know, without September 11th, we still would have realized how much this sucked. Spiegel says, from which corner do you expect the greatest challenge? Virus makers, hackers, spam senders? Gates says, there will always be people who try to take advantage of the medium by bothering us with marketing stuff, which is fast, easy, and cheap to distribute worldwide. We'll be able to control that to some degree because the sources allow themselves to be traced back. The people who create advertisements from a certain company usually receive money from that company that makes them traceable. We have been making enormous progress on this front. I worry more about whether our general dream will be fulfilled. Now, here's where it really gets interesting. Spiegel says, what is that dream? Gates says that we can globally communicate with one another without mistrust and can do it more creatively. To do this, for example, is important that your identity is safe on the internet. In the end, it involves a promise, the promise of the digital age, but also I also do not believe that the current difficulties can really endanger that. So, of course, yeah, we want to be able to do things safely and trusted as well. Spiegel says, Microsoft is not only a part of the solution, but also, because of its market power, part of the problem. When a company provides more than 90% of all personal computers with software installed, it is inevitably a target for hackers interested in it causing the most damage possible. Gates says, there is actually a large number of operating systems in addition to Windows, for example, such as the OS from Apple or Linux and Unix. So he's really downplaying this whole idea that, okay, like he's out there on 90% of the PCs. Yeah, there's other OSs, but the next thing we're going to focus on is security, and we'll see how that goes.
They've been saying that for like 5 years.
Spiegel, in the realm of the normal personal computers, they don't play a large role worldwide. Gates says, the truth is, the fewer operating systems there are within a company, the better it is from a security point of view. So he's saying, the more you have one of one type of system, the easier it is. Now, I understand from reading this article that he's probably talking about that it's one solution, one way to manage it, one way to, you know, patch it up, configure it, and all that stuff. But also, on the back end, it's also one system to take down. It's all coming together, and it makes it a lot easier. So when you start having multiple systems, it's, for instance, like, here's the simplest way to explain it. You have, like, a lake. And if you cut off anywhere in that lake, then the downstream, like, if you just fill it in, the downstream is done for. But if you have all these little tributaries and breakoffs, and all of a sudden you cut off one or two areas, the water's still getting down the hill. Spiegel says, I beg your pardon. Gates says, simply because one must spend billions of dollars to ensure the security of each individual system, our company has an unbelievable number of people who are solely responsible for this type of security around the clock. But they don't have enough people because they still have problems all the time. And it's great that they've taken that initiative, and I'm happy but that they have. But it's still a problem. And here is some more information. Spiegel, the particular charm of Linux is that it's an adaptable system that users can shape themselves. Gates, if everything runs under the same platform, however, you can better concentrate resources and more quickly repair errors. For instance, in a hospital where different systems are used, a single problem in one section can cause the other systems to crash. Thus, from a security standpoint, it is always better to focus on one system. He just said it right there, that a single problem in one section cause other systems to crash. That's right. In his system, you can have a problem in one Windows machine, it can spread to the other one, and they may have this exact same problem, and it just causes systems to crash. So I don't understand how he says, from a security standpoint, it's better to focus on one system. Now, I do understand it is easier to focus resources on one system instead of multiple systems, but in the age of Microsoft, until those things get a lot better than what they currently are, and they have gotten better, but it's still a problem. In the few hours of Windows, okay, and then Spiegel says, in a few hours, a Windows virus can travel across the world like an epidemic. Gates says, above all, because of our global popularity. So, well, let me finish the whole thing. But we know that, and we must apply still more time and money to it. However, spam and data theft are not questions of the operating system. For this, you also need laws and global standards. But he just said it right there. Spiegel says, look, the problem is that it can travel so fast because you guys are very popular and a lot of people use your operating system. He says, well, yeah, it's because we're popular. And which you think a little bit deeper, he just said that it travels so fast because we have more market share because it's one system with a problem and it travels through that system so easily. So it's really like backwards in the sense that what he was talking about earlier, that it's easier to manage the one system. But it's not easier to manage. You may be patching or do whatever you can, but it's still getting hit and bombarded. So it's not so easy. It is a lot easier when the system is honed in on and made a little bit less vulnerable to begin with. And Spiegel says, once again, Windows is the most vulnerable. Gates says, you could look at that in many ways. The speed from which, for example, the Linux community reacts to problems is not especially high.
Oh, really?
That's because this system, unlike ours, simply does not keep thousands of people on standby to deal with problems. Because Microsoft keeps thousands of people on standby.
And yet they come up with a security release once a month instead of when something breaks.
Yeah. In this respect, a commercially distributed operating system also has decisive benefits. Sweeping judgments don't help because we have to take the problems... seriously, even Linux developers know that there's no miracle cure in Linux land. They too must continue to work and continue to make progress. So obviously everyone understands that there's no miracle cure, but it's totally not true that people in the Linux community don't react very fast because, as we've talked about in previous shows, these people are developers with names that, you know, in order for them to work on projects or to really keep their name, you know, their reputation's on the line. It's a lot different than an employee at Microsoft that you really have no clue who wrote the code, and you know, it's going to be shuffled off to the thousands of people that they have standby anyways. And the thousands of, you know, the people on standby, every developer in the Linux community is on standby for their projects, and even if somebody catches it before them, they have the ability to even say, hey, I found a fix for your problem. Here's the fix. You take a look at it. You approve of it. Put it on your website so your users of that program can download it. and make things better for, you know, something more secure, and or even work better, you know. And so I really wonder, like, does Bill really believe what he's saying, or is it just kind of like he just has to say these things, you know, to keep the focus? And I understand he has a product that he wants to back, but you know, we're the users out here, and we're going to pick it apart, and we're not going to take you know, we're gonna look at what's really real, and what's really real is not exactly what he's saying. In the past 15 years, Microsoft has time and again been a target of lawsuits and court disputes. Your company already was required to pay billions of dollars in penalties. The accusers and cases all have the same complaint. Microsoft continues to pack additional innovations into the Windows platform at no cost, virtually annihilating competitors in the long term. Why do you promote this strategy, Gates? Which strategy? In the software sphere in which we operate, the only thing only one thing matters, the benefit to the customer. And there were more improvements, there than in any other economic sector. You need only look at what Microsoft Office or Windows could do 10 years ago, and what these programs cost back then, and what capabilities they offer today, at what price. The costs are going down, the capabilities are increasing with tremendous speed. We should really wish that all other sectors, from the automotive industry to politics, would bring us improvements similar to our sector as far as innovations and revolutions are concerned. The software business is really not one where one can rest one's laurels. So the article goes on, but those are the main things I wanted to bring up. The thing is that, you know, if you add these extra features in the operating system, it is good for the customer, I guess, but it's also pretty bad once those features are used to cause a lot of problems. So there's a dual-sided coin to the whole thing. And, I mean, me personally, I guess I could be a little bit more honest if I was, you know, Bill in there, be like, look, we're trying to do this, we did that, or whatever. But, you know, he's just coming from the standpoint of this illusion of you know, never giving any you know, credit due to any other thing beyond Microsoft. You know, they're continually doing what needs to be done, and they're okay in doing so, and you know, don't always place the blame on them. So yeah,
definitely.
The wise words from the Bob.
The Bob.
All right, well, soon we're gonna be playing the interview here with Rocket from Inner Zone. He's going to be talking about Inner Zone West and the Hacker School gray area. But I also want to bring up this nifty puzzle online that I have alluded Bob to and a few other people.
And it will absolutely drive you insane.
But it's awesome.
At the same time, yeah.
Yes. Basically, you go to notprawn.com, or you can also go to deathball.net/notprawn/. It gets you to the same spot. But basically, this is a, I don't know how to say it, like, what, there was this one, what was it, there's an old movie called, like, Video Game or something like that. When you played the game, it was a scary movie. When you played the game, like, it affected your real life and all that crap. This doesn't do that, but, or like, you know, you think of like the 976 evil, you call the number and it used to call you back and all that stuff. This doesn't really do that per se, but it's, but it's a game that's from a web browser, okay. You think, okay, well, there's only so much you can do. Oh, we're going to bring up that other thing, too. But it's a game from a web browser, but you have to really think outside the web browser. And some of the things that you might want to think outside the web browser are like, you know, it'll give you information. Sometimes you might have to go look it up. You got to do some searches. You might have to look at the source code. You might have to look at the URL name. You might have to look at what's going on the screen. You might have to click something. There might be something hidden. I'm giving you little hints here because, trust me, you're going to need it. And it's still going to be hard. You know, you might want to look at what the title of the web page says and all sorts of stuff. And there's always little things in this. And the whole idea is to get to the next level. So you start out on 1, 2, 3. And from what I've read, there's actually 80 levels. I'm on 10 right now. And it's pretty interesting. There's the forums. Like, they're pretty good at not telling anything out of the ordinary. They'll give you, like, some more hints. And they're very good at not posting the exact answer, so I find out that that's good. But yeah, check it out. Go to notprawn.com or deathball.net/notpronounced/, and you can play the game. It's free. It's fun. I guess you can even get a guide for it. It's like 100-some pages you can buy. So some people played it. Only 350 people have passed it, according to their records. 350 people have passed it from 42 countries, and it says 61 of them are women. The average age of the players is about 24. Okay, and then also, what was it, everyvideogame.com?
I believe so, yeah.
Let's check that out. This is something that actually Bob showed me last night, which was pretty neat. It's a website called everyvideogame.com. And what it does is, if you have Java installed, you can play Game Boy, Nintendo, and the old Sega Master System from the browser itself. So you can basically go, you click on a game, and it will open the game up in the browser, and you can play it. Now, the one thing I didn't like is that for, like, if you do, like, Game Boy or whatever, their screen is very small.
Yeah, so it's really like that for the NES, too.
Yeah, for Nintendo. The Sega one's a decent size. But, yeah, all the games are there. You can play. The only problem is you can't do any saving, so there's no saving at all. And the one thing I was thinking about, and I was like, you know what? Maybe they can't get busted for this, because it's almost like going to your friend's house and playing their game. Maybe this guy actually has, like, an arcade store or whatever. He owns all these games. And all he's doing is just allowing you to play his game. On this website, there's no way to download it. I'm sure you can look at the code and see where it's fetching the ROM from, and you could probably grab it. But it doesn't promote, like, downloading the ROMs itself. You don't click on it, it says download it. You click on it, and it launches the Java applet, and you play the game from there. So it's almost like if you know, this person may own these games, and I haven't really read into the site, but maybe this person actually owns these games, and he's just allowing you to play his game, you know, and you don't get to take it home, and you don't get to keep it. And
what a nice guy.
What a nice guy. So, you know, that's my idea. You know, I should actually kind of take a look in here and see. There's a forum on here, too, and see really what it's all about, and how, you know, how this is up here, because, you know, it doesn't seem like they're getting busted or taken off the net yet. And I don't even know if they could get taken off the net if it was in the way I was talking about. So that's pretty interesting. Check those two links out. The next show is going to be up here soon also. And so I know we're bringing this one up a little bit late. But the next one will be up soon. And post the forums. Check out those websites. Play that game. All right, so coming up next is our interview with Rocket. He's going to be talking about Interzone again, March 11th through the 13th in Atlanta. Check that out. If you haven't gotten your tickets, man, you need to get those things, because it's hard getting tickets at the last minute. But you're going to get some details on what's going on. If you're already going, you'll get the heads up. So check that out, and here we go. Well, this is Slip Mode with the In the Now Show. We've got Rocket here from Interzone, and we're going to be asking a few questions about Interzone and everything else that's going on with projects you're working on. Say hello, Rocket.
Howdy. Good evening to everybody.
All right, so what we're doing right now is we're actually doing this over an internet program called TeamSpeak, and that has a few limitations. It's not as back and forth as doing a phone call per se. So if you do notice any delay or anything like that, it's because we're doing it through the internet. But I think the audio is coming through pretty good. And here we go. All right, so tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got started doing Interzone, Rocket.
Well, we went to DEF CON and a couple of the other conventions and decided that there were things that could be done that weren't being done at some of the other conventions, so we created Interzone. We are similar to some of the other conventions somewhat, and we're different. We do take on some of the issues that aren't necessarily focused on in some of the other hacker conventions, primarily privacy rights, and some other legislation that's being introduced that needs a keen eye on, and some other things where student rights at some of the universities are in question. These are some of the things that we take on. There's some of the other conventions don't.
Okay, so, like, we're talking security-related, but we're also talking, like, political, environmental, as far as kind of a lot about what we talk about in the In and Out Show. We'll talk a lot about subjects of how the impact of technology is impacting our social environment, our, you know, our environment period on many other levels other than here's this, you know, new chip, you know, go at it. You know, this is this new Linux version, you know, check it out. You know, things beyond that, things deeper.
Yes, exactly. There are just so many topics out there that people need to be educated on, and we just hope very extremely that we are an avenue for that.
Great, that sounds good. And that's, you know, personally when I've gone to, like, conventions myself, like I've been to, you know, DEF CON Hope, I even spoke at Hope, and I've really enjoyed, you know, an atmosphere where it's less like this elitist thing of let's talk about hacking and who's cool and stuff like that, which I'm not saying that all cons are like that, but getting away from that environment and going more towards, like, grassroots, like, what is this? What does this mean to everybody? What does this mean to you and me? What's going on in the world we have today? All right, well, if anyone wants to check out InnerZone while we're talking about it, you can go to innerzone.com, and that's the zone has a zero in it instead of an O. So check that out. And where is the conference going to be held at? When is it, and how much is it going to cost, Rocket?
The InnerZone Convention is March 11th, 12th, and 13th, and it's located in Atlanta, Georgia. Actually, we're in suburbia this time in an area called Marietta. We are at the Holiday Inn. For directions and et cetera, check the website out.
All right. Are they running any room specials or anything like that for conference attendees anywhere?
Well, we had originally got the hotel to agree to do a $79 a night rate. That was supposed to have ended about a month ago, and we commissioned to keep it all the way through the convention. So, yeah, the rooms are still discounted at a $79 per night rate, and even the suites and stuff are discounted also.
Okay, so in a room, like, was it like two beds? You probably, I don't know. Hackers or, you know, computer techie guys could probably don't mind being stuffed in there with like five, six people. But how many people do you think it usually sits in there?
I'm not going to incriminate anybody. So four people into the room is the norm. Four people can split $79. If you do it some other way, I just don't want to know about it.
Okay, yeah, I completely understand that. Okay, so yeah, that's coming up here very soon. And what now? There is a speakers list up, correct?
Yes, it's on the website, and it's still kind of a tentative schedule. We're flipping, flopping, and rescheduling. And as soon, probably Monday night, the 9th, will be the Monday. I guess it's the 7th. Will be probably the final schedule up.
Okay. How many rooms is what's the overall layout of the con going to be? Rooms, and is there going to be a vendor area, stuff like that?
Well, we've changed venues this time, so we're trying some new things. The ballroom will be divided into three sections, with one of those sections as the largest of the speaker rooms. One section will be a round table breakout area, which we emphasize the use of because, this is about a community type of thing. The other section will be something that we're introducing because we used to have the ghetto hackers come in and do our root foo, and they are just not doing that anymore. So we went in conjunction with HackSec out of Ohio, and they are introducing a new type of capture the flag contest called Packet Wars. So that will be one area of the ballroom. And then we have a couple additional speaker rooms, and then we also have our 101 track, Hacking 101, Coding 101, Wireless 101 track in another room also.
Awesome. That sounds awesome. As far as, like, internet, what are we going to have for the people to get on the net?
There will be a wireless available, and we do a minimal, we're trying to move away from a wired LAN, but we will still have a wired LAN there this year.
All right. And this is the fourth InnerZone. How did this is a yearly thing, correct?
Well, the first year we did one and two within a year. Then we decided to go ahead and just go back to once a year, springtime, with the InterZone here in Atlanta. So, yeah, this is the fourth one.
Okay. And the first one started when? And let me know how that – how did you go about, you know, getting the idea to pull this off? Probably that you wanted to see other cons. I remember you telling me that before. When was the first year of InterZone?
First year was 2002. The InterZone 1 and 2 were held in let me get this, the dates right. We did InterZone 1 in October 2002, and we did InterZone 2 in, I think it was April of 2003. 2004 was in March, and we're in March again.
Okay. And your keynote speaker is Simple Nomad. He's going to be speaking on the state of computer, of the computer underground, what's working, what's not, and why.
Yes, I've heard Simple Nomad speak at several other gatherings, and he's always impressed me. His word seems to be right on the button, and we hope that he gets a good attendance during his speech. I think, seriously, it's stuff that needs to be heard.
Yeah, I have gone through and I've looked at all the speakers, and I actually know some of the people that are on here. And, yeah, it looks like you have a great lineup. What are, like, some of the topics that you're looking forward to going to? I'm sure you're happy with all of them because you're the one that chose them all. Anything really interesting sparking your attention?
Well, so I look forward to hearing Simple Nomad. We've got some people this year that haven't talked for us in the past because their topics have struck a chord with, I think, you know, the information that, you know, needs to be out there. There's always a couple of my speakers that will be doing zero-day devotions. A couple of new tools will be released this year. I know that one of those tools was slated for Jeff Ma's Black Hat over in Asia, and actually we're getting it released here before he does. So it's going to be an interesting convention with a lot of surprises this year.
Yeah, I was thinking that's actually was going to be kind of like leading my next question is what do you think is going to be different, or what are you trying to achieve with this conference that you know, beyond what you've achieved on your previous three?
Well, first of all, so I want to say that the model that we run InterZone under is we try to affect change through education. And I'll divulge one of the model or one of the sayings that we've got printed on this year's T-shirt. We're mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore. And some of the things that will be surprises this year kind of go up that alley.
All right. Yeah, there is, I mean, man, you know, technology is just getting more integrated into society, you know, in evil ways and in good ways. And it's, you know, becoming part of everyone's daily lives, whether they like it or not. You know, whether they're, you know, from a child all the way to an adult. And these things are impacting us, you know, and some of them negative and some of them positive. And I don't know, one of the biggest problems I see is the ability to, you know, have devices in everyday lives that have the ability to do something negative or tracking or you know, monitoring or, you know, it's something that could easily get out of control, and people have shown to abuse these things in the past, and it looks like things are going to be abused in the future.
I agree with that statement. The one thing that we would like to also target this year and is kind of a community open discussion on how the hell can we end spam, and let's do it. It is eating our resources, it's eating our bandwidth. We need to put a stop to it. One of the other things, there's a topic that isn't scheduled and will not be scheduled because we have already at InterZone been served cease and desist orders and restraining orders. And with that in mind, we've decided not to broadcast or publicize at least one of our topics this year.
Wow. Now, I've maybe because I haven't ran a con myself, maybe things like this occur, you know, when people are speaking on subjects that others may not like. How does, what is that? What is, I mean, is somebody out there saying that, you know, somebody can't speak, or is this somebody from a company that's saying, look, you're talking about private information and you're not allowed to speak because we have a non-disclosure? Or how, what is that?
Well, it's not necessarily the non-disclosure. There are companies out there nowadays, and including our own government, that don't want us to publicly say stuff. We're using the courts and civil lawsuits and various other means to stop our First Amendment rights. In protection of our rights, we're not divulging certain topics or what time they will be scheduled until the commission starts. Just kind of slows down those who want to, you know, stop us.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's, man, I didn't even know things like that occurred. But it doesn't surprise me. It really doesn't with a lot of the things that I've seen going on in the world today. All right. Well, tell me a little bit about InterZone West. It's a break off of InterZone, and it's got a few other things going on.
InterZone West, San Francisco Bay Area, most likely, if we sign the contract with the hotel, will be the first weekend of October. It is going to be a little bit different than the InterZone that is offered in Atlanta. InterZone Atlanta, we consider a hackers convention. The InterZone West, we are going more IT professional and targeting some of the issues that are actually in the IT community that need to be addressed, and various things, you know, like antivirus development, more secure firewalls. We're going to try to target some of the corporate world that needs to be educated instead of necessarily the run-of-the-mill sysadmins. Maybe I'm not saying that, you know, properly, but we're not alienating anybody. We want everybody to attend, but we're just going to be a little bit more on a professional level instead of the HackerCon. And we're still focusing on educating.
Okay, yeah, I understand that. You know, a lot of the things is that, you know, you have this world of people that are dealing with technology and, you know, for instance, even the government or lawyers or, you know, all sorts of people that don't really understand the ins and outs of technology and beyond, like I said, you know, how something works, but what it really does to society and how it plays a role and stuff like that. And things like that need to be, you know, hackers and techie people that have this information. You know, it's good that some of that information gets spread down to the people that don't normally deal with this stuff on a regular daily basis, so they understand the importance of it, so they understand what's going on, so their network isn't contributing to the spam because they just, you know, just run everything unpatched or whatever. So awareness is a very important thing, and that's what we try to do here at In the Now, and I'm sure that's what InterZone's going to be doing for a lot of people.
Well, we hope so. You know, I mean, there are many different avenues of educating the people, and we've been pushing through our website. We've got a link to your show, and word of mouth is one of the best advertising medias there is, and the word's out. Your show's hot, and I'm just hoping in return people think the InterZone's hot.
Absolutely. Okay, well, now we're there's some other projects that you guys are working on besides InterZone West, and we're talking about education. Tell me a little bit about what Gray Area is.
Gray Area is the non-traditional security academy. We saw a very open space in security education. Rules that are out in that are in existence right now, teach test answers. You know, they're, you know, quick answers to how do I go past my cert test, and they are not, they're, like I said, they're teaching test answers. They're not teaching methodologies. They're not teaching skills. They're teaching what we have a tendency to call these people idiot drones. Know how to take a test, but do not know how to complete the job. Probably the best example I can give is the Microsoft MCSE that now stands for it's not worth the paper it's printed on, and it stands for must consult someone else.
Yeah, that's very true. I know a lot of people that, you know, have their MCSEs, and they have those boot camps, you know, it's like 3 or 4 days to, like, you know, and some guy walks in, he's like, sure, you know, I know how to administer, like, 200 computers on an Active Directory network. It's just, you know, it's just not going to happen. So are we talking more hands-on experience? We're talking, you know, we're obviously talking teachers that that are there understand it and are coming from an aspect that's, you know, utterly important for the real education of the subject.
Also, we're coming from the thought process that if you know how to hack it, you know how to secure it. Now, I've been fed many, many arguments that I'm wrong in teaching that way, but we teach, it's called gray area for a reason. We teach the black hat, we teach the white hat, and from ways that it has not been taught before.
Okay.
It is very intensive. I don't want to call it the boot camp school, but it is very intensive, and all the classes do have labs, so you actually do learn the skills that are required. In our hacking information warfare class, we actually have a competition at night after the class so that you actually get a chance to hone the skills that we've taught you that day.
All right, that sounds very good. And what are the primary subjects that this school is going to be focusing on?
Basic skill sets with the information warfare class, all the way up through the most advanced with the divulgence of even the latest zero-day faults that have been released a day or two before. How to code properly, and how to code securely, virus mitigation, and even some new theories on IDSs through visualization type of programs, where you can actually basically watch graphs and stuff like that. I don't want to go into complete detail, but we're taking IDS a different way. Basically, where you can monitor hundreds of computers on a laptop or whatever and see exactly what is happening.
All right. Yeah, that sounds very good. You know, I mean, I don't take any issue with teaching, you know, how to hack it is learning how to secure it, you know. And that's, I mean, honestly, that's exactly like how I learned. And, I mean, I set up my own computers. You know, I've got tons of computers. I've used those. I've set up shell servers and, you know, hey, slip, you know, run this and see how, you know, well you can do it securing it. So I really believe that's one of the better ways to go. I mean, it's just you can't learn how to, you know, I guess in a religious sense, heal a sinner if you've never sinned. So, but, you know, there's ways of doing that kind of education and doing it legally, and I think it's very effective. Okay, so this kind of school, one last question on gray area. Does this provide like a degree, a certification, or how does this work?
Yes, everybody will get a certification of participation, and we are seeking other certifications that we can hand out.
All right. Well, if I don't know if there's anything you'd like to add. I think I've gotten a lot of great information about Interzone West, gray area. Interzone, obviously, March 11th through the 13th. If you haven't gotten your tickets, get them now. This can be a great conference down in Atlanta. Go to interzonewithazero.com, and you can grab all the information. Anything else you'd like to add, Rocket?
No. I appreciate you having this conversation with me, and look forward to doing this again sometime.
All right. Thanks, Rocket. And this is Slip Mode signing out with the interview with Rocket with Interzone March 11th through the 13th.
Thank you, Slip Mode. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, that was our interview with Rocket. Thanks again for having the interview with us, Rocket, and hope to talk to you again in the future. Interzone's a great conference, and I think that Rocket's doing a lot of interesting things over there. So check that out once again. And this is Slip Mode signing out. I'll see everyone in 2 weeks.
And this is Bob signing off. Peace.
ST, what I represent. NY, hold it down for my peace in the field and do a job on the record, let it be known. Chrome to seal and anyone in these lists can blow your grill. Show your skill. You want more? Hold your steel. You want more? Unload tax. You all can feel. Raw deal. All peel. Run for the hill. Trust the deal. The battle.
feels black and real. Smoke dope, you know my name, I'll be the same since the days that I'm laid down. Push me to the point, got a straight round. Take a street like for a game, acting like clown. Always playing, you ain't busting off, just shooting the breeze. Cause you scared of the repercussion after we squeeze. You ain't been through what I did just to get where I'm at. Streets where I rap and PK where I be at. Cause Brooklyn where we live at.
Let me show you what's really going down. You bunch of clowns, frontin' like you really hot. Understand, can you really not? Hype is all you really got. Blow your spot, we pack it in like a circus. Basically, let me just love the way we work this. Spit that official rap. From the what? Rap contest. Knock it off with your nonsense. The hot that's been to. Down is bound to hit you. I have the members in your crew. Here we up to get you. Blind mill, stay up in my senses. All the time. I stay finessing. That's the case. I gotta teach a lesson. No question. Competition mean nada. You make it hot for me and mine. So we make it hotter. Yeah. Hey, yo. Where this way I be at? Yo, I'm at the color when I'm good. Yo, sorry.